The World Series, The Possible Dream. October 23rd, World Series, Game 1. I email Stewart. I think Wake is a great choice for Game 1. Sure, he's a risk, but he'd be my choice. He might tie those big thumpas in knots. Even if he doesn't, I give Francona kudos for giving Timmy the ball. And for God's sake, he's gonna put Mirabelli behind the plate, right? Right. See you 5:30. Steve, I still believe, King.
I'd violently disagree with Steve. Wake is his boy as much as Dave McCarty is mine. And Wake's been plain awful this year, besides the few usual wins in Tampa. The best thing he did was volunteer to mop up in Game 3 against the Yanks and give Lowe his spot in the rotation. Footnote. All right, I'm no ingrate. He saved our bacon in extras in Game 5, holding the Yanks scoreless for 3 nervous, passed-ball-filled innings and picking up the win. But I'm out the door and sailing across I-84 before Steve's email reaches me. It's been a long time since I've been to a World Series, and I aim to get my fill. The souvenir shops around the park don't open until noon. At 11:30, lines of eager buyers stretch far down the block. The amount of free junk people are handing out is astounding. Papers, posters, buttons, stickers, pictures, temporary tattoos, Krispy Kreme donuts. Fans are staggering around with bags of the crap in total material overload. When the stores open, barkers with bullhorns herd customers into switchbacked ropes. This line only for World Series and AL champion merchandise. This line only. Hanging out by the parking lot 8 hours before game time, the autograph hunters are treated to an impromptu concert by Steven Tyler as he runs his soundcheck for tonight's anthem. Steven doesn't actually sing the song. He just blows an A on his harmonica and runs through an ascending series of bluesy scales and sounds great. A cool reminder that Aerosmith started out as an electric blues band influenced by the early Stones, the Yardbirds, and Muddy Waters. After that, PA announcer Carl Bean warms his pipes, rumbling, "Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the National League champion, St. Louis Cardinals," over and over, as if he might have trouble with it later. He goes through a fantastical lineup. Batting first, number 1, Carl Bean. A minute later, batting fourth, number 9, Ted Williams. And the crowd outside applauds. Batting fifth, number 6, Stan Musial. And speaking of old-timers, rumor is that Yaz is throwing out the first pitch. A sentimental touch, and overdue, since it's said that Yaz and the club haven't had the best of relationships since he retired. The new owners may be trying to patch things over. We also witness, well in advance, the return of Lenny DiNardo and Adam Hizdew, two guys who spent time with the club early in the year. It's nice to see the Sox are giving them a taste of the big show, though of course the guy we really want to see is Dauber. Two other early arrivals of note. Team physician Dr. Bill Morgan and 15 minutes later, wearing a brace on his right leg and no shoe in the cold, Kurt Schilling. Before Game 6, Dr. Morgan sutured Schill's tendon to his skin, a procedure he practiced first on a cadaver. Rumor, again rumor, the outsider's substitute for information, is that he's going to stitch him up again for tomorrow's start in Game 2. On those few threads, our whole season may depend. Inside, there are more banners than I've seen all year. A lifting of the normal ban, for TV's sake, I expect. It's cold, with a wind whipping in from straight center, which should give Wake's knuckler more flutter. Even the stiff wind isn't enough to keep David Ortiz in the park tonight. In the first, in his very first World Series at-bat, El Jefe busts out with a 3-run golf shot over the pesky pole. We chase Woody Williams early, giving Wake a 7-2 lead going into the fourth. Beside me, Steve is smiling. Kevin, the usher who comes down between innings with a camp chair to keep people off the wall, is overjoyed with how things are going. Nah, I say glum, just watch. Wake'll start walking people. He always does when we give him a big lead. And I don't say this to jinx anything. I say it because I've seen Wake all year long, and that's just what he does. And that's just what he does. Walking 4 in the fourth to break a World Series record. And soon after he's gone, it's 7-7. It's like they used to say about Fenway when it was a launching pad. No lead is safe here.
Man, that was ugly, Orlando Cabrera said in a post-game interview. He paused, then added, but we won. Ugly pretty well sums up the first game of this year's World Series, which ended with a thing of beauty. Keith Falk striking out Roger Cedeno a few minutes after midnight. Speaking of ugly, Orlando wasn't looking so good himself in that interview, and he seemed uncharacteristically solemn. A Woody Williams pitch hit him on the shoulder in the first inning, then bounced up into his face, leaving him with a bruised chin, a fat lip, and a temporary inability to smile, which, under ordinary circumstances, Mr. Garcia Parra's replacement does often. Pain or no pain, Cabrera must have been at least tempted to test that smile when the Red Sox finally escaped with an ugly but serviceable 11-9 win in spite of four errors, one by Bronson Arroyo, starter Tim Wakefield's fourth-inning relief, one by Kevin Millar, and two by Manny Ramirez. Every one of those errors led to runs, leading me to wonder if any of the Red Sox players felt tempted to visit the Cardinals' clubhouse after the game and assure them on behalf of the home team that Boston doesn't play that way every night. Cabrera might have been even more tempted to test his swollen lip if informed of this statistic. In World Series history, the team drawing first blood has gone on to win the Fall Classic 60% of the time. Still, there's that other 40%, and the fact that the Cards have yet to lose during this postseason on their home field. But, fingers crossed now, you've got to like the Red Sox going into Game 2. They're nice and loose. What could be looser than four errors and four walks issued by Red Sox pitching? Their demonic arch rivals are behind them, and they're riding a nifty five-game winning streak. Last night's game began with a moment of silence for Victoria Snellgrove, the young woman killed by a pepper gas ball during riot control operations outside Fenway following Boston's final victory over New York. And while it was both decent and brave of the current ownership to remember her, one is tempted to believe that the previous bunch of caretakers would have swept Ms. Snellgrove under the rug as fast and as far as possible. It was also a reminder of what is truly ugly in our brave new world, where all game bags are searched and the clocks tick on Osama meantime. There were lines of Boston police, looking like puffy Michelin men in their riot gear, watching impassively as the happy and largely well-behaved crowd left the old green First New England Church of Baseball with the strains of dirty water still ringing in their ears, and the memory of Mark Bellhorn's game-winning, foul-pole-banging home run still vivid in their minds. To me, those dark lines of armed men outside such a place of ancient and innocent pleasure are a lot harder to look at than the mark on Orlando Cabrera's face or his swell lower lip. 11-9 is a crazy score for a World Series game. So is a total of 24 hits and 5 errors. But the bottom line is that we won. Father Kurt takes the mound tomorrow night on home turf with his freshly restitched ankle, and that's a beautiful thing. A remarkable one, anyway. I only wish Tori Snellgrove was around to see it.
The most surprising thing to me about Game 1 was how the faithful booed Dale Swaim during the pregame introductions. I suppose it's a delayed, or should I say sustained, reaction to Johnny being thrown out at home in the first inning of Game 7 of the ALCS. Whatever it is, I don't like it. And despite the win, I don't like the way Kevin Millar played, leaving 10 men on, making essentially two errors on the same play, double-clutching that cutoff, then throwing the ball into the dugout, and later not getting anywhere near a ball hit down the line that both Minkiewicz and McCarty handle easily. By contrast, the Cards' Larry Walker took to the big stage in a big way, making two great catches in right, a Manny liner down into the corner with men on, and a windblown pop he had to run a long way and then lunge for at the last second, and hitting a double, a homer, a single, and another double. This is Walker's first World Series, after a long and brilliant career in the hinterlands of Montreal and Colorado, and it was heartening to see him show the world his A game. If Pujols, Rowland, and Edmonds had done anything to help him out, we'd be down 0-1. Mark Bellhorn, meanwhile, seems determined to enforce the curse of the ex-Cubs. That is, the team with more ex-Cubs is bound to lose the series. The Cards have 5, while we only have 2, Marky Mark and Billy Miller. Before his home run off Julian Tavares, he was 2-for-3 against him lifetime, so his success didn't surprise me, only the magnitude of it. It was no fluke. Tavares didn't fool him at all. Marky Mark ripped the pitch before his pesky pole shot, high and deep down the line in right, but foul. All he had to do was reload and straighten it out, making him one of a very rarefied club. Players who've homered in 3 straight postseason games. October 24th, World Series Game 2. On the street outside the players' lot, I run into Andrew on his way out to buy some salads for the guys. We're surrounded by a crowd of tourists, hoping to catch a glimpse of the stars. Camera crews, cops. Andrew still can't believe this is all happening. A common reaction among the nation, even those deep inside it. I ask him about Shill's ankle, and tell him about seeing Dr. Morgan yesterday. Yeah, he says, they had him on the table, but he tried to stay away from there. How's he look, I ask. Andrew just shrugs. We'll have to see. Inside, I catch Tony Womack along the left field wall, joking with an old friend in the stands about beating him at golf next week. When he gets a break, I ask him how his collarbone feels after taking that David Ortiz smash off it last night. I'm fine, he says, and I tell him how much I'd been rooting for him in spring training. You ran great, bunted great, stole bases. I wish you could have played the field. Man, he says, shaking his head, they didn't want me. We shake hands, and a minute later he calls Larry Walker over. Walker looks puzzled until he sees Tony's friend. You know this guy? Tony asks. Know this guy, Walker says. This guy owes me $8,000. It's Sunday, and in the concourse, crowds are gathered around the wall-mounted TVs watching the Patriots beat the Jets for their 21st consecutive win. If the Pats can win 21 straight, the logic goes, why can't we win 8? Our seats are down in the corner where I normally post up for BP. Better seats than I'm used to. How good? Above us in the monster seats is Jimmy Fallon. And 2 rows in front of us, so close I could lean forward and touch his shoulder, is Eagles quarterback Donovan McNabb. He played an outstanding game today in Cleveland, his long scramble setting up an overtime win. He must have showered and gotten right on the plane. He's so tired that the only time he stands up during the game is to go to the restroom. But like us, he stays for every drizzly, windswept pitch.
October 25th. One summer night in the mid-1960s, right around the time the Beatles were ruling the American music charts, a young music producer named Ed Cobb happened to be walking with his girlfriend beside the Charles River in the quaint old city of Boston, Massachusetts, or so the story goes. Out of the shadows came a thief who tried to mug him out of his wallet, or maybe it was out of her purse. On that, the story is not entirely clear. In any case, the musically inclined Mr. Cobb foiled the thief and got an idea for a song as a bonus. The song Dirty Water was eventually recorded by a group of Boston proto-punks called the Standells and released by Capitol, who wanted a record Cobb had produced for Ketty, Anyone Who Ever Had a Heart, Lester. No one expected much from the raw and raunchy Dirty Water. Footnote. In my high school, the phrase lovers, muggers, and thieves was routinely construed to be either lovers, junkies, and thieves, or lovers, fuckers, and thieves. But it went to number 11 on the Billboard pop charts and has remained a standard on the Boston club scene ever since. It was revived by the new Red Sox management and has become the good time signature of Boston wins. For the Fenway faithful, there's nothing better than seeing the final out go up on the scoreboard and hearing that 6-note intro with the familiar first note slide leading into the verse, "Down by the river." And so it seemed a particularly good omen to see the resurrected Standells in deep center field before the game last night. A lot grayer and a little thinner on top, but still loud and proud, singing about that dirty water down by the banks of the River Charles. A great many things about baseball in general, and the Red Sox in particular, are about the bridges between past and present. This was just one more provided by a current Yawkey Way administration that seems pleasantly aware of tradition without becoming enslaved to it. And when the Red Sox had put this one away in the cold mists of a late Sunday evening, the sounds of dirty water rang out again, this time with the tempo a little faster and the tones a little truer. And why not? This was the one recorded when the Standells were young. This is the version that hit the charts 4 months before Kurt Schilling was born. He was awesome last night. The word is tired, clapped out from overuse, but I've had a 170-mile drive to try and think of a better one, and I cannot. The crowd of just over 35,000 in the old green Church of Baseball knew what it was seeing. Many of them may have been in Fenway Park for the first time last night. These series-only fans are what Globe writer Dan Shaughnessy so rightly calls the Nouveau Nation. But even they knew. The galaxy of flashbulbs that went off in the stadium, from the plum dugout seats to the sky views to the distant bleachers to those now perched atop the green monster, was chilling in its cold and commemorative brilliance, declaring by silent light that the men and women who came to the ballpark last night had never seen anything quite like it for sheer guts and never expected to see anything quite like it again, not certainly with their own eyes. Edgar Renteria, the Cardinals' leadoff hitter, battled Schilling fiercely. First 6 pitches, then 10, then a dozen, running the count full and then spilling off foul after foul.
Footnote. To prolong or deepen this drama, the pitch speed display above the wall in left center was tantalizingly blank for this half inning. Who knew what Schill had? Only Tech and the hitters.
He might have been the game's key batter, and not the ones Schilling had to face following more Boston miscues, another 4, that allowed the Cardinals extra chances upon which they could not capitalize. Before finally hitting sharply to shortstop, and the often maligned Kevin Millar made a fine pick at first to complete the play, Renteria tried every trick in the book. Every trick, that is, save one. He never attempted to lay down a bunt. In 3 starts on his bad peg, 2 against the Yankees and now 1 against the Cardinals, no one has tried to make Kurt Schilling field his position. I'm sure the Red Sox infielders have discussed this possibility and know exactly how they would handle it, but it has simply never come up. And when this thing is over, when the hurly-burly's done, all the battles lost and won, someone needs to ask the Yankee and Cardinal hitters why they did not bunt. Of course I can imagine the boos that would rain down on a successful bunter against Father Curd at Fenway, but is it beyond the scope of belief to think that even Yankee or Cardinal fans might find it hard to cheer such a ploy for reaching first? Well, maybe not Yankee fans. Could it have been, don't laugh, actual sportsmanship? Whatever the reason, the Cards played him straight up last night. I salute them for it. And for the most part, Father Curt mowed them right down. Tony Womack and Mike Matheny had singles. Albert Pujols had a pair of doubles. And as far as hits against Schilling went, that was it. He finished his night's work by striking out the side in the 6th. For the Red Sox, it was a continuing case of 2-run, 2-out thunder. 2 runs scored after 2 were out in the 1st. 2 more after 2 were out in the 4th. 2 more in the 6th. The same way.
Footnote. Respectively, Tech with a triple to the triangle that's out if the wind isn't blowing straight in, Marky Mark with a similar bomb off the wall in dead center, and O'Cab, who was uncharacteristically ahead in the count all night, bonking one off the monster.
By the end of the game, Mike Matheny ground out, the deep green grass of the field and the bright white of the Red Sox home uniforms had grown slightly diffuse in the thickening mizzle. The departing fans, damp but hardly dampened, were all but delirious with joy. One held up a poster depicting a Christ-like Johnny Damon walking on water with the words, "Johnny Saves," beneath his sandaled feet. I heard one fan, surely part of Mr. Shaughnessy's Nouveau Nation, actually saying he hoped the Red Sox would lose a couple in St. Louis so the team could clinch back on its home soil. Yes, Beavis, he actually said, home soil. I had to restrain myself from laying hands on this fellow and asking him if he remembered 1986, when we also won the first two, only to lose four of the next five. And when a team is going this well, red-hot Red Sox trumpets this morning's USA Today, one loss can lead to others. Winning two at home, within a sniff of the River Charles, may have been vital, considering the fact that the Cardinals have yet to lose a single postseason game in their own house. Tomorrow night, Pedro Martinez will face the Cards near the dirty water of a much larger river in a much larger stadium. It will be his first World Series start, and given that no team has ever climbed out of an 0-3 World Series hole, and surely that sort of thing can't happen twice in the same postseason, can it? I think it's going to be the most important start by a Red Sox pitcher in a long, long time. Certainly since 1986. October 26th, World Series Game 3. I email Stewart. Dear Stewart under the arch, here's my idea of the doomsday scenario, also known as the novelist's ending. The Bo Sox win one game in St. Louis, come back to Boston up 3-2, lose Game 6, and have to start Father Kurt for all the marbles in Game 7. Stewart, this could actually happen.
I'm hoping we can steal one out there. And hey, if we get two, I won't be crying about eating my Game 6 tickets. It's just like the Yankee series. We just have to win one game, the game we're playing.
All looking good. Now, if Pedro can only do his part, you know, I think he will.
Pedro remains inscrutable. We can't hit like it's a regular Pedro game. We have to pretend it's John Burkett out there. Think 7 or 8 runs. Go Sox. The Sox are up 4-0 as the game rolls into the ninth, and I find I can't sit down. As Fulk comes in, I'm muttering the lyrics to his Fenway entrance music. Danzig's mother. And if you want to find hell with me, I can show you what it's like. He gets Edgar Renteria, then has Larry Walker 0-2 when he just lays a fastball in there and Walker golfs it out. I watch Johnny turn and watch it. Then I'm out of the room swearing and pacing through the house. It's okay, we've got a 3-run lead and there's no one on. Folky just has to go after hitters and not walk anybody. Pujols gets behind and jaws at the ump after a borderline call. Then skies one deep to left. Oh, crap. That Manny settles under. Phew. That's two. Scott Rowland, 0 for the series, is taking. Gets behind. Then inexplicably takes the 1-2 pitch, which, while slightly in, is clearly a strike. And the ump punches him out to end the game. We're up 3-0, and I'm jumping around the room. Petey came through so big, and Manny and Billy Miller hitting with two down. We're a game away. I've been a strike away before, so I'm already trying to play it down. But damn, I didn't expect us to ever be up 3-0 on the Cards. The idea of winning it all sends me romping through the house, bellowing the Dropkick Murphy's Tessie, even though I don't know all the words. Up from third base to Huntington, they'd sing another victory song, 2-3-4.
Boston has now won 7 games in a row, tying a postseason record, pushing the Cards to the brink where the Red Sox themselves stood only a week ago. The most amazing thing about the World Series part of the Red Sox run is that the Cardinals have yet to lead in a single game. Their manager, Tony La Russa, certainly knows this, and while his part of the post-game news conference seemed long to me, it must have seemed interminable to him. He looked more like a middle-level racketeer being questioned in front of a grand jury than a successful baseball manager. Part of the reason for La Russa's long face may have had to do with the game's key play, which came in the third inning, when Cardinals base runner and starting pitcher Jeff Suppan was thrown out at third. Suppan led off the inning with a slow roller to third. Miller handled it cleanly, but not in time to get Suppan at first. Edgar Renteria followed with a double to right that had Trot Nixon falling on his ass because of the wet conditions in the outfield. Footnote: it rained heavily in St. Louis right up until game time, and the warning track was a swimming pool. I hate it when teams are forced to play ball under these conditions, but it's the same old sordid story. When Fox talks, Major League Baseball walks. If this is going to continue, the Players Association ought to consider insisting on pads and helmets, at least for the outfielders, after October 15th. Supon probably could have scored right there, tying the game, but perhaps he was held up by the third base coach. We'll give him the benefit of the doubt anyway. So with runners at second and third and nobody out, up came Larry Walker, a gent who is absolutely no slouch with the stick. He hit a ground ball to Mark Bellhorn. At that point, the Boston infield was playing back, conceding Supon's run, which would have tied the score 1-1. But Supon didn't score when Walker made contact, nor did he when Bellhorn threw Walker out. Instead, he broke toward home, broke back toward third base, then broke toward home a second time. Meanwhile, Boston's new kid on the block at first base, David Ortiz, in the lineup because the designated hitter doesn't exist in National League parks, was observing all this. From Ortiz's side of the diamond, Supon must have looked as frantic and disoriented as a bird trapped in a garage. He fired across the diamond to Bill Miller, just as Supon darted back toward third base a second time. Supon dove for the bag, but Miller was able to put the tag on him easily. The result of this beer league base running was that instead of tying the score against one of the American League's craftiest power pitchers with only one out, the Cardinals found themselves with two outs and no run scored. Albert Pujols followed Walker, grounding out harmlessly to end the inning. The Cards would not score until the bottom of the ninth, and by then it was too late. The irony, La Russa's long post-game face suggested he did not need this pointed out to him, was that the National League team had been screwed by the very rules that were supposed to tip the scales in their favor. It was their pitcher who made the base-running blunder, and our erstwhile designated hitter who saw it happening and gunned him down. Although Boston got a pair of insurance runs in the fifth, more two-out thunder from Manny Ramirez in the first.
Footnote: followed in the bottom of the inning by Manny's perfect one-hop peg on a short fly to nail Larry Walker at the plate and keep us up 1-0. This moment of redemption after Manny had made errors on consecutive and very ugly plays in Game 1. Cardinals third base coach Jose Oquendo, like so many other baseball people, mistook Manny's spaciness for lack of ability. Anyone who's watched Manny throw knows he's amazingly accurate and that Walker had no chance.
And Bill Miller, batted home by Trot Nixon in the fourth, were all the run support Pedro Martinez needed. He, Mike Timlin, and Keith Falk spun a gem. Following Edgar Renteria's double in the third inning, Red Sox pitching retired 18 Cards in a row. Larry Walker broke up the string with one out in the ninth, turning around a Keith Falk fastball to deep left center for a home run. So now the St. Louis deficit is 0-3. One would like to say that lightning cannot strike twice on the same patch of ground, and certainly not so soon. But in truth, one cannot say that, especially not if one happens to have been a Red Sox fan for the last 50 years and has had the cup snatched away from his lips so many times just before that first deep and satisfying drink. I don't think I've ever been so aware of the limitations of this narrative's necessary diary form until today. You sitting there listening are like an astronaut who can see the entire shape of the Earth, where every sea ends and every coastline begins again. I just go sailing along from day to day, hoping to avoid the storms and writing in this log when seas are calm. And now I think I can smell land up ahead. I hope I'm not jinxing things by saying that, but I really think I can. Not just any land, either, but the sweet promised land I've been dreaming of ever since my Uncle Orin bought me my first Red Sox cap and stuck it on my head in the summer of 1954. "There, Stevie," he said, blowing the scent of Narragansett beer into the face of the big-eyed seven-year-old looking up at him. "They ain't much, but they're the best we got." Now, 50 long years later, they're on the verge of being the best of all. One more game and we can put all this curse stuff, all this babe stuff, all this 1918 stuff behind us. Please, baseball gods, just one more game. I email Stewart. "Ah, but I begin to smell exotic spices and strange nerds, nards. Could these be the scents of the promised land? I can only hope they are not scents sent by false sirens on hidden stones beyond a mirage of yon beckoning shore. But I digress. We rock tonight, dude."
It's good to be up 3-0 instead of down 0-3. But the job's the same. Win the game we're playing. The guys have to stay on top of it.
"You must have been eating the post-game spread with Tito."
October 27th, World Series Game 4. It's Trudy's and my 20th anniversary today. We were supposed to be in Chicago last weekend, eating at Charlie Trotter's and the Billy Goat Tavern, the honest-to-God home of the Cubs curse, as well as the Cheeburger Cheeburger skit from SNL. But those plans dissolved in the face of Games 1 and 2. Tonight, at Trudy's insistence, I call and cancel our long-standing dinner reservations at the best restaurant in town. I don't tell the maitre d' why. "Enjoy the game," he says. Signs and portents everywhere. Tonight's the 18th anniversary of our last World Series loss, Game 7 to the 86 Mets. Not only is there a full moon, but right around game time, there's a total lunar eclipse. By the time I go outside to see the lip of the Earth's shadow cross the Sea of Tranquility, Johnny has us up 1-0 with a leadoff home run. Later, when Trot doubles on a bases-juiced 3-0 green light to give us a 3-0 lead, the eclipse is well underway, casting a decidedly red stain. Blood on the moon, or is it a cosmic nod to the Sox? For the third game in a row, Lowe pitches brilliantly, giving up just 3 hits in 7 innings. Arroyo looks shaky in the 8th, but Embry relieves him and is perfect for the 2nd straight outing. As Folk closes, I'm standing behind the couch, shifting with every pitch as if I'm guarding the line. At this point, for no other reason, it seems, than to torture us, Fox decides to show a montage combining all the horrible moments in Red Sox postseason history, beginning with Enos Slaughter, moving through Bucky Dent and Buckner, and finishing with Aaron Boone. I hold a hand up to block it out, to eclipse it. At this moment in Red Sox history, I do not want to see that shit. It's not bad luck, it's bad taste, and whoever thought it was appropriate is a jerk. With one down, Pujols singles through Folk's legs, right through the 5-hole, a ball Folk, a diehard hockey fan, should have at least gotten a pad on. We're nervous. Another runner, and they'll bring the tying run to the plate. But Folk's cool. He's got that bitter disdain, that nastiness, really, of a great closer. He easily strikes out Edmonds, now 1-for-15, then snags Edgar Renteria's comebacker and flips to Minkiewicz. And that's it. It's that simple. The Red Sox have won the World Series. While we're still hugging and pounding each other, Trudy's crying, she can't help it. Steph's laughing. I'm just going, wow, wow, wow. Caitlin calls from Boston. In the background, girls are shrieking. She's at Nickerson Field, formerly Braves Field, where BU is showing the game on a big screen. I can barely hear her for the noise. "They did it," she yells. "They did," I yell back. There's no analysis, just a visceral appreciation of the win. I tell her to stay out of the riots, meaning keep away from Fenway, and she assures me she will. It's not until I get off the phone with her that I realize the weird parallel. When I was a freshman there, my team won the World Series too. It's more than just a win, it's a statement. By winning tonight, we broke the record for consecutive playoff wins with 8 straight, Another stat that every commentator unpacks is that we're one of only four championship teams to have never trailed in the series. Footnote: along with Tony La Russa's 1989 A's, the 66 O's, and the 63 Dodgers. All three, like the Sox, had a pair of aces. Dave Stewart and Bob Welch with the A's, Jim Palmer and Dave McNally with the O's, and Sandy Koufax and Don Drysdale with the Dodgers. Thanks to Johnny, O.C., Manny, and Poppy, we scored in the first inning of every game, and our starters, with the exception of Wake, shut down St. Louis's big sticks. Schill, Petey, and D'Lo combined for 20 shutout innings. Much respect to pitching coach Dave Wallace and his scouts for coming up with a game plan to stop the Cards. As a team, they batted 190, well below the Mendoza line. Scott Rolen and Jim Edmonds went 1-for-30, that one hit being a gimme bunt single by Edmonds against a shifted infield. Albert Pujols had zero RBIs. Reggie Sanders went 0-for-9. It's not that we crushed the ball. We scored only 4 runs in Game 3 and 3 in Game 4. Essentially, after the Game 1 slugfest, we played NL ball, beating them with pitching. And in the last 2 games, our defense was flawless. In finally putting the supposed curse to rest, we dotted every I and crossed every T. And to make it all even sweeter, the last out was made by Edgar Renteria, who wears, as a couple of folks noted, the Babe's famous number 3.
October 28th. It came down to this. With 2 outs in the St. Louis half of the 9th and Keith Falk on the mound, Falk, the nearly sublime Red Sox closer this postseason, only Edgar Renteria stood between Boston and the end of its World Series drought. Renteria hit a comebacker to the mound. "Stabbed by Falk," crowed longtime Red Sox radio announcer Joe Castiglione. "He underhands to first. The Red Sox are world champions. Can you believe it?" I hardly could, and I wasn't the only one. 100 miles away, my son woke up his 5-year-old son to see the end. When it was over and the Red Sox were mobbing each other on the infield, Ethan asked his father, "Is this a dream, or are we living real life?" The answer, it seems to me this morning, is both. The only newspaper available at the general store was the local one. The others were held up because of the lateness of the game. And the Sun Journal's huge front-page headline, of a size usually reserved only for the outbreak of war or the sudden death of a president, was only 2 words and an exclamation mark. At last. When the other New England papers finally do arrive in my sleepy little pocket of New England, I'm confident that they will bear similar happy headlines of a similar size on their front pages. A game summary would be thin stuff indeed compared to this outpouring of joy on a beautiful blue and gold New England morning in late October. Footnote. And the summary is simple enough. Once again, last night, we hit and pitched. The Cardinals did neither. Only one Cardinal starter, Jason Marquis, managed to stay in a series game for 6 innings, and the heart of the St. Louis batting order, Pujols, Rolen, Edmonds, got only a single run batted in during the entire 4-game contest. It came on a sac fly. Usually, when I go to get the papers and my 8 a.m. donut, the little store up the road is almost empty. This morning it was jammed, mostly with people waiting for those newspapers to come in. The majority were wearing Red Sox hats, and the latest political news was the last thing on their minds. They wanted to talk about last night's game. They wanted to talk about the series as a whole. They wanted to talk about the guts of Curt Schilling, pitching on his hurt ankle, and the grit of Mr. Lowe, who was supposed to spend the postseason in the bullpen and ended up securing a magical and historical place for himself in the record books instead, as the winner in all 3 postseason clinchers. Game 3 of the Division Series, Game 7 of the League Championship Series, and now Game 4 of the World Series. And while none of those waiting for the big-time morning papers, the Boston Globe, USA Today, and the New York Times, came right out and asked my grandson's question, I could see it in their eyes, and I know they could see it in mine. Is this a dream, or are we living real life? It's real life. If there was a curse, other than a sports writer's brilliant MacGuffin for selling books, amplified in the media echo chamber until even otherwise rational people started to half believe it, it was the undeniable fact that the Red Sox hadn't won a World Series since 1918, and all the baggage that fact brought with it for the team's long-suffering fans. The Yankees and their fans have always been the heaviest of that baggage, of course. Yankee rooters were never shy about reminding Red Sox partisans that they were supporting lifetime losers. There was also the undeniable fact that in recent years, the Yankee ownership, comfy and complacent in their much bigger ballpark and camped just downstream from a waterfall of fan cash, had been able to outspend the Red Sox ownership, sometimes at a rate of $2 to 1. There was the constant patronization of the New York press, the Times, for instance, chuckling in its indulgently intelligent way over the A-Rod deal and concluding that the Yankees were still showing the Red Sox how to win even in the offseason. The jokes and the jibes. The ball through Bill Buckner's legs in 1986 was horrible, of course. But now Buckner can be forgiven. What's better is that now the Bucky Dent home run, the Aaron Boone home run, and the monotonous chance of "Who's your daddy?" can be forgotten, laughed off even. On the whole, I would have to say that while to forgive is human, to forget is frickin' divine. And winning is better than losing. That's easy to lose sight of if you've never done it. I can remember my younger son saying, and there was some truth in this, that when the Philadelphia Phillies finally won their world championship after years of trying, they became just another baseball team. When I asked Owen if he could live with that as a Red Sox fan, he didn't even hesitate. "Sure," he said. I feel the same way. No one likes to root for a loser, year after year. Being faithful does not save one from feeling, after a while, like a fool, the butt of everyone's joke. At last, I don't feel that way. This morning's sense of splendid unreality will surely rub away, but the feeling of lightness that comes with finally shedding a burden that has been carried far too long will linger for months, or maybe even years. Cubs fans now must bear the loser legacy all by themselves. They have their curse of the billy goat, and although I am sure it is equally bogus.
Footnote. Not so. That one's real and solidly documented.
They are welcome to it. Bottom of the ninth, two out. Albert Pujols on second. Red Sox Nation holding its breath. Falk pitches. Renteria hits an easy comebacker to the mound. Falk feels it and tosses it to Mankiewicz, playing first. Mankiewicz jumps in the air, holding up the index finger of his right hand, signaling, "We're number one." Red Sox players mob the field while stunned and disappointed Cardinal fans look on. Some of the little kids are crying, and I feel bad about that. But back in New England, little kids of all ages are jumping for joy. "Can you believe it?" Joe Castiglione exults. And 86 years of disappointment fall away in the length of time it takes the first base ump to hoist his thumb in the out sign. This is not a dream. We are living real life.
While the babe may be resting easier, I barely sleep and wake exhausted, only to watch the same highlights again and again, seeing things I missed while we were celebrating. As the Sox mob each other, in the background, Jimmy Fallon and Drew Barrymore are kissing, shooting their fairy tale ending to "Fever Pitch." Nice timing, Farrellys. Footnote. So many storylines wrapped last night. Manny, who went unclaimed on waivers, is the World Series MVP, and very possibly the regular season MVP as well. Lowe totally vindicates himself, making him an incredibly attractive free agent. The same with Pedro. Terry Francona goes from the coma to a legendary Red Sox manager. Orlando Cabrera, who stepped up big in the number two slot and fielded brilliantly in the postseason, makes us forget Nomar. The year is signed, sealed, and delivered. All that's left now is the Boston Duck Tours parade, and the team deciding who gets a World Series share. As always, I hope Dauber's not forgotten. In short center, right behind second base, Curtis Laskanik lies down and makes the natural grass equivalent of a Patriots snow angel. The crawl says, "Red Sox win World Series," and I think, yes, yes, they did. It did happen. It was no dream. We're the world champions, finally. And there's that freeing sense of redemption and fulfillment I expected, the same cleansing feeling I had after the Pats' first Super Bowl win. The day is bright and blue, the leaves are brilliant and blowing. It's a beautiful day in the nation, maybe the best ever. And yet the season's over, too. There will be no more baseball this year. And while I've said I wouldn't mind eating my tickets to games 6 and 7, it feels wrong that I won't be back in Fenway again until April. Just for fun, I go to the website, choked with new World Champions merchandise, and poke around, looking for spring training information. There's a number for City of Palms Park, but when I call it, it's busy. It's going to be crazy there next year. If I want to get in, I'd better start working on it now. I flip the pages of our 2005 calendar to February and March, and wonder when Trudy's school has its break. I wonder if there's a nicer hotel closer to City of Palms Park, and whether they'd have any rooms left at this point. I have to stop myself. Okay, calm down. There's no need to hustle now, the very morning after. I can take a day off and appreciate what we've done, what they've done, the players. Because as much as we support them, they're the ones out there who have to field shots we'd never get to, and hit pitches that would make us look silly, and beat throws that would have us by miles. And the coaches and the manager, the owners and the general manager, who have to make decisions we'll never take any heat for. They did it, all of them together. Our Red Sox. Congratulations, guys, and thank you. You believed in yourselves even more than we did. That's why you're world champions, and why we'll never forget you or this season. Wherever you go, any of you, you'll always have a home here, in the heart of the nation. Go Sox! I email Steve. You know how the papers are always saying you bring the team bad luck? Well, the one year you write a book about the club, we win it all. Another fake curse reversed. Not in your lifetime, huh? Well, brother, welcome to heaven.
How do you suppose Angry Bill is doing?
He's in that box of a room in Vegas, grumbling about something, probably the Bruins.
Are you going to the VR Day Parade?
No, but tonight I ate that Break the Curse cookie I got on opening day. A vow's a vow. Washed that stiff 6-month-old biscuit down with champagne and enjoyed every morsel. Life is sweet. Off to drink more champagne. You and Johnny D are still the man.
No, Stuart, you and Poppy are the man. I'm giving you the 2-pointy-finger salute.
Right back at you, baby. Keep the faith.
The End. You've been listening to Faithful. Two diehard Boston Red Sox fans chronicle the historic 2004 season by Stuart Onan and Stephen King. Narrated by Adam Gruper and Ron McClarty.